Public Radio News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. As Granite Staters sit down to the bounty of Thanksgiving this week, an upcoming food-related fight in the legislature may cross the minds of a few lawmakers, a bill to require labeling for genetically modified organisms or GMO foods. While New Hampshire farmers produce few of these products, most Granite State consumers eat them often in a wide variety of products, from cornflakes to Wonder Bread. The push to label GMOs on supermarket shelves has come largely from groups worried that these foods could be harmful to human health. But critics of this bill charge these concerns are unsubstantiated, and on top of that, requiring brand new labels will unnecessarily increase food prices. In both sides of the debate are ultimately much more nuanced than their talking points, leading to a complicated decision for New Hampshire lawmakers. But at least they're not alone. Roughly 20 states have had bills pending recently on this issue, with Connecticut and Maine both passing labeling legislation and California and Washington voting it down. Today in The Exchange, we tap into this GMO debate, examining the arguments for and against labeling, especially how it could affect New Hampshire growers, grocers, and consumers. Let's hear from you. How do you come down on the GMO labeling question? Do you see this as a good idea? What are your concerns about it? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a short comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. We have three guests in studio. Sam Evans-Brown is here, NHPR's environment reporter. He's been following this bill. And Sam, thank you for giving us your time.
Anytime, Laura.
Also with us, Janet Wilkinson, executive director for the New Hampshire chapter of the Northeast Organic Farming Association, or NOFA. And Janet, welcome. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Laura.
Also joining us by phone is Robert Johnson, policy director for the New Hampshire Farm Bureau Federation, which has taken a position against the GMO labeling bill. And Rob, welcome back. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, Sam, I want to start with you. What exactly does GMO mean? What are we talking about here?
So a GMO crop is anything that has had traits from another species, and it can be another species of that plant, but more frequently it's something entirely different. So say you're working with corn, it could be a trait from bacteria, it could be a trait from, you know, a jellyfish that has been genetically removed from species A and then been inserted into species B so that you can get things like pesticide resistance or herbicide resistance are very frequent traits that people are that are desirable. You can also have you can inject things so that they'll produce more nutrients so you can deal with sort of malnutrition problems. But really, most frequently, we're talking about crops that have been made more herbicide resistant is how industry has used this most frequently.
Yeah. And how is this different, Sam, from conventional genetic breeding, you know, where you make corn stronger by breeding it with a stronger breed of corn?
Well, it's really that you, taking things from species that could not breed with corn. You could not breed a
naturally
bacteria with a piece of corn. You know, it just simply doesn't work. It's an entirely different process. And this has been a point in the debate, is how different is that process really? And I think a lot of the concerns that we'll talk about later are stemming from that fact that you can take traits that could introduce, you know, allergens or things like that that you wouldn't be able to introduce through conventional breeding.
Well, I think you're getting to my next question, Sam, which is, why does this issue seem to touch such a nerve with some people? One state lawmaker involved says she's gotten more calls on this bill than anything else, even gun legislation, which usually gets people, you know, fired up.
Sure. I think, well, I mean, you have seen over the years the growing interest in sort of local foods and concern about the sort of industrial model of agriculture. And I think, right or wrong, GMOs have become sort of a proxy for that entire fight. And then if you fold into that the fact that there are people who are concerned about health issues, which, again, may or may not be substantiated, you combine two constituencies of people who are really worked up about their respective issues.
What do you think, Janet? Why does this inspire so much passion in people?
Well, it's interesting. I think from the organic perspective, GMOs have been around for about 20 years, and organic agriculture has been around for more like 15,000. So we're grounded in kind of a conservative practice. And I think people are becoming aware that this is very new and fairly unproven as a practice in agriculture.
So it makes people nervous because it's such a departure from what we have long, long done.
Exactly.
Is that resistance to change, or is that, do you know what I'm saying? I mean,
yeah.
Is it possible that just because it's new doesn't mean it's bad?
Absolutely, it's possible, but I don't think that people have seen the evidence to feel good about that being the case yet.
What do you think, Rob Johnson? Why does this issue inspire so much passion in people? We hear so much from folks about this issue.
It's powerful technology, or one, and it's the unknown to a lot of people. And people, I think, are always concerned, scared of the unknown. One thing I'd like to point out, when Sam gave his introduction, he talked about the transfer of genes. And I also wanted to add that it's not always the transfer. Sometimes, like when you're talking about the Roundup Ready function, it's just simply the disabling of a gene to prevent photosynthesis in a certain path.
The disabling of a gene within a corn plant or a wheat plant. That helps it be more hardy. Is that what you're saying, Rob?
It enables the herbicide to work.
Okay.
Or enables Roundup Ready to work, I should say.
All right.
And it does it in a very precise, quick way.
Which is beneficial to farmers.
Correct.
If I could just get to the New Hampshire angle of this, all of you, because this has been a giant national debate, and even international, the European Union has largely come out against GMOs. But here in New Hampshire, Sam Evans-Brown, the bill isn't, you know, we're banning these products or we're favoring them. It's for labeling. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so the language of the preferred language of the bill, because there's the bill that was voted down in committee, but there's also the language that they would like to introduce eventually, and that's really what we're talking about. It's a regional mechanism. So you'd have to have five states within the region would have to okay similar bills before it were to kick in, and then after that trigger is pulled, you'd have 18 months before companies would have to start including this on their label. And the type of labeling depends on exactly what we're talking about. So if it's a raw agricultural product, if you wanted to just sell, you know, kernels of GM corn, it would have to be sort of conspicuously labeled up front. And if it's a processed food product, the label could be on the back in conspicuous language is the exact word, but it's not necessarily doesn't necessarily have to be conspicuous. So you could have, you know, the nutrition facts, and then at the bottom where it says contains, you know, nuts, it could also say contains GMO crops.
Sure. So Janet, as I'm sure you're familiar with the concern that, you know, boy, if New Hampshire has one set of rules and Arkansas has another set of rules and Minnesota has another set of rules, that's kind of a nightmare for food processors. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And this bill has been brought forward a few times in past years. A big change with the current legislation and the current amendment that's brought forward is that it's in line with the legislation of 64 other countries around the world that already require GMO labeling, including all of Europe, South Africa, China, Japan, Vietnam, a lot of South America. And it's also in line with two bills that have already passed in Maine and Connecticut. So we feel like this is a good timing moment for us to step forward and make an amendment to the New Hampshire bill and help move forward as a region and encourage our New Hampshire legislators to be leaders on this issue.
So if New Hampshire does this, other states will follow suit. Is that what you're saying?
The hope is that it's really about constituent awareness and their interest in this subject matter. And I think that we're, you know, the timing is just right where Maine is already hyper aware, Vermont, it's halfway through, Connecticut, it's already been passed. So we feel like if that momentum continues, that we could, as a region, pass a regionally strong legislation.
What do you think, Rob? I mean, I know some farmers have said, hey, let's just do this at the federal level. It's too complicated to have a patchwork. But the other side would say the feds aren't really known these days for getting much of anything done. So why not do it state by state and create this momentum that Janet talks about? What do you think?
Well, our position is that any regulation of biotechnology must be at the federal level, that they have the expertise and the resources to regulate it properly. And it, as you alluded to earlier, it makes sense in terms of commerce, you know, to avoid various and conflicting regulations.
But given that what we've seen in Congress, you know, they're not exactly known for moving at lightning speed, Rob, as you know. So if this is something consumers want, pretty safe to say it's not going to happen in Washington anytime soon. So, again, why not state by state or region by region?
Well, FDA has a science-based labeling regime currently where they label things relevant to health, safety, and nutrition. And it must be truthful and not misleading. And the overwhelming science currently found by our regulating agency is that there isn't a health safety issue here, and that our belief is that by mandating a label, we're not opposed to voluntary labeling, but by mandating labeling, it's misleading that there is a health or safety concern.
Getting into some of the issues about whether this is really a health or safety concern or not. We should definitely talk about that after a short break. But Sam, you want to jump in more on the labeling issue.
Right. I just want to point out, and I think Rob was alluding to this, but explicitly we should say that it's not necessarily something that Congress has to do. There are a lot of people who think that the FDA has the authority to require this labeling already. And that's the Just Label It campaign that is being pushed by Gary Hirschberg from New Hampshire is making that argument that FDA has this authority, and they're just sort of arguing that the bureaucratic route is one that we could get some federal labeling happening.
Wow. And this is Washington politics, which isn't our expertise, Sam, but I'm wondering if the FDA did try and go ahead with this. It doesn't look like they will, but if they did, I'm imagining they'd get some pushback
from folks in Congress. But as you say, we are not experts in Washington politics up here in New Hampshire, so I will not comment.
All right. Well, maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that after a short break. And Rob's point about labels must not be misleading. I know you've got some thoughts on that, Janet. So we'll talk after a short break. The phone number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Please keep those emails short. Keep your Facebook comments short as well. NHPR Exchange is our Facebook page, all one word. Or give us an old-fashioned phone call, 1-800-892-6477. We'll be right back.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. Want to know what's going on this week at NHPR? Well, there's an easy way for you to find out when you sign up for our e-newsletter this week at NHPR. You'll find out what the exchange, word of mouth, and our newsroom are planning for the week and get a behind-the-scenes look at the station. Click on the Connect menu to sign up for our e-newsletter at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Comcast Business supporting New Hampshire Food Bank's collection of non-perishable food items at the New Hampshire for the Holidays Expo December 7th and 8th, more at eventsnh.com. From Wentworth Douglas Hospital supporting healthy communities in the seacoast of New Hampshire and southern Maine, wdhospital.com. And from jobsinnh.com, connecting New Hampshire employers with local qualified job seekers. JobsInNH.com, how New Hampshire gets to work. Online at JobsInNH.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a look at the debate over labeling genetically modified foods. It's a bill coming up in the legislature. It's already aroused passions on both sides. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. Our guests for the hour are Janet Wilkinson, Executive Director of NOFA. That's the Northeast Organic Farming Association. She's Executive Director of the New Hampshire chapter. Also with us, Rob Johnson, Policy Director for the New Hampshire Farm Bureau Federation, and NHPR's Environment Reporter, Sam Evans Brown. One more time, the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Lots of folks who want to jump in into our conversation. So let's go first to Janet in Contoocook. And hi, Janet. Thanks for waiting. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Thank you very much for taking my call, Laura.
Sure.
I want to say, first of all, I agree with Rob Johnson that genetic engineering is a powerful technology, and it is advancing us into the unknown. And just by way of background, I volunteered to serve on a citizens committee at UNH, in 2001 and 2, and the purpose of the committee was to study GMOs. And so what I learned was, our final report issued in February of 2002 made three main points. One, this technology is insufficiently tested. The FDA relies on companies to provide safety information. It does not do independent testing. We were concerned about the impact on the environment, and we recommended strongly that these products be labeled because this technology was known, and if there were unexpected consequences, labeling would provide a way to trace back the problem. And medicine had high hopes in genetic engineering. In fact, there were two young boys who lacked immunity. They had to live in a bubble. Their doctors felt that by a genetic transfer, they could confer immunity on these boys. What happened was the oncogene for leukemia was inadvertently turned on, and both young men died.
Relate that to food, Janet, if you could, please.
I certainly will. So when Rob says, and I quote him, this is a precise, quick way to advance plants, the problem is that there are unexpected consequences, and just recently, over 200 scientists signed the European Network of Scientists for Social and Environmental Responsibilities group statement.
And Europe has definitely been opposed to these. And we should probably talk about that a little bit later and how they deal with the labeling issue and how they deal with GMOs overall. But Janet, thank you for the broader point that you make about unexpected consequences. And Rob, we touched on this concern a little bit earlier, and I do want to hear from you since Janet addressed you directly. You know, she's expressing the fear that a lot of people have. We just don't really know what we're doing here. I wonder what you think.
Well, in conventional plant breeding, there's a slew of genes that are transferred, genes that are responsible for the desired traits as well as those responsible for unwanted traits. And there have been some issues with health or safety. There have been health or safety issues when conventional breeding is. There was an issue with a potato, and there was another with cotton, and the results of the picking and workers, the effect on them. Under genetic engineering, which is can be the transfer between varieties, it's very precise and it quickens the process. I mean, the conventional it can take a fair amount of time.
The conventional, ahead, Rob.
The conventional conventional plant breeding. Each process, plant genome is altered. The difference is the tool being used.
Okay, the difference is the way that we do it. What do you think, Sam Evans-Brown? I want to hear from you too, Janet.
The first thing I'd say is that I think this is kind of the crux of a lot of folks' arguments, is that even if you accept the reviews of the science that have been done by a lot of big organizations, you know, the American Medical Association, the European Commission, all these have basically concluded that we have no evidence of health impacts related to consumption of GMOs. But the argument then becomes, what about the future? You know, this is such a new technique. We don't necessarily know what could be introduced, and something could be harmful, and there isn't sufficient pre-market testing. And this is a big concern of the GM crowd, which is that basically there's a voluntary consultation basis through which these are tested. That, you know, Monsanto produces a crop, and then they do their own testing, and they show that to the FDA, and the FDA says, okay, it looks okay, put it out on the
market. So
there's
no independent testing,
right,
as Janet expressed. We've heard this concern from others.
And even groups like the American Medical Association that have found that there is no evidence of health impacts from GMOs say that we ought to have stronger pre-market testing because we don't know what could crop up in the future. And if we aren't testing robustly, who knows what we'll get ourselves into.
Janet Wilkinson, what do you think to Janet's call? And Janet, thank you very much for chiming in.
Yeah, that gets to exactly the point of this legislation. I mean, the reality is we all are in an experiment. 80% of what is the processed food in grocery stores right now contains genetically modified organisms. And we can't know, we can't trace back to which ones are working and which ones might not be working. There's a great quote from Margaret Mello of the Union of Concerned Scientists, who says, "It does not appear that there's any risk that applies across the board to all genetically engineered food to all people. Each plant is different, each gene insertion is different, and each person's response is different." And we're concerned about that.
Well, so give me that percentage again. How much of 80% the food we commonly, you know, cornflakes,
processed food, yep,
cookies,
yep,
canned soup, whatever.
Absolutely.
80% of processed foods. Mm-hmm. We're not talking so much about the apple that you might buy.
Correct.
Or so forth.
Just yesterday, I believe, in Canada, there was a go-ahead for producing genetically engineered salmon. And there would be no label required on that. You wouldn't know.
Well, here's a question for you, Janet. So 80% of the processed food out there already contains GMO foods. I mean, society has its problems, but we're not all falling down dead because of this. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's not so bad. Maybe it's not so dangerous as you and our caller, Janet, fear.
Maybe not. So why not label it then so that we can know?
Yeah, and okay, Rob, I got to throw that to you. So, all right, so you're not concerned. Others are concerned. Why not label? And then everybody can just make up their own mind.
Because it stigmatizes at the stage we're in the product. This it's not science-based. And again, the current regimen that FDA has, it's science-based, health, safety, nutrition. If we're going to label for this, what's next? Are we going to label for certain pesticides, use of manure, growing the crop? Where's the line? What and through labeling, really, what useful information is it going to yield with the current proposal?
It seems, though, that there is a mass of people who want this particular information. So why not give it to them?
Well, I would offer that the marketplace is going to take care of it.
So voluntary labeling.
Yeah.
People will say, our food, by the way, folks, does not contain GMOs. And you see that already, don't you, Rob?
Yeah, you sure do.
Well, and I want to go to our callers, but Jan, I got to ask you this. Okay, so if I'm an organic food producer and I have no GMOs in my corn checks, then I can tout that. I can say, hey, buy my corn checks.
Absolutely.
So what's wrong with that? Why do we need a law?
We think there's a great market for non-GMO, non-organic food. They're estimating $800 billion by 2017 for that non-GMO food market. So that's great. But in terms of that skull and crossbones effect that we keep hearing about, that's really a marketing challenge to the biotech industry and required labeling of orange juice from concentrate and tobacco are two examples of labels that were thought would lead to skull and crossbones and a loss of market share. And obviously, they didn't. I mean, you see the labels on tobacco now.
All right, so, I have a lot more questions, yeah, but lots of people who want to jump in by email, exchange@nhpr.org, Facebook, NHPR Exchange, all one word, and by phone, 1-800-892-6477. Peter's calling from Dover. Hi, Peter, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I had the pleasure of heading the House subcommittee that was inviting a number of experts to come in and speak about this. And one of the issues that came up was the question of what is the basis of our current national labeling or non-labeling scheme, and that goes back to 1992 and the FDA, and at that point the Bush Quayle administration was trying to push for more biotechnology and input, and at that point there was the scientists at the FDA had real questions about whether or not this was advisable, and they suggested that labeling would be appropriate. Their superiors overrode that, and as a result, we got a policy. There was, however, an attempt to do rulemaking, and in that period when they were doing rulemaking, they took a lot of public comment. They didn't actually make a final rule. So there was no rule in the 1992 to 1994 range.
So we've been talking about this for a long time. Peter, if I could ask you a question, since you said
sure.
you chaired the subcommittee on this bill. And as you know, the subcommittee said yes to GMO labeling, but the full committee said no. They were worried about free speech. They were worried about the costs to producers and so forth. Why do you think the full committee said no to this while your subcommittee said yes? Just briefly, if you could.
The one issue is the cost. There were a number of people on the full committee who felt that this should be done at the federal level rather than the state level.
And how do you feel about that?
I think that if we could induce the federal government to do it at the federal level, that would be ideal. And one of the things we are trying to do with this bill is, and coordinating with other states, is provide enough of an impetus at the state level to show that the federal government that they really need to act on this. And so this is a classic case of the states leading. I think that in order to get the appropriate federal labeling and federal pre-market testing that should be in place, we need to do like what the suffragettes did in the early 1900s and push for state legislation that points to where the federal agenda should be going.
Okay. Peter, thank you for calling. And good to hear from someone who was so heavily involved in this. Sam, I'd love your thoughts, too. You covered this whole process in the legislature. Peter told us his subcommittee said yes to GMO labeling, but the full committee said no.
Yeah, and I think the full committee vote is going to point to a lot of the political difficulties that this is going to face going forward. Representative Bixby, when I talked to him afterwards, said that he thought that this would get more support in the full House, that if you bring it before the full House, which is majority Democrat, that you might be able to get it through there. But when you look at the vote in the committee, you see that it was sort of bipartisan. You had Republicans and Democrats voting both ways, but more Republicans voted no than Democrats. So once you get this before the Senate, it's going to have a tougher row to hoe, as it were.
All right. Well, thanks again, Peter, for calling in. And up next is Bob in Hudson. Hi, Bob. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Laura. Thank you very much for having me. I just wanted to call in because I am the ranking minority member on the House Environment and Agriculture Committee. And I was one of the no votes to this bill.
Okay, and what were your concerns, Bob?
My concerns there's three of them. The first is the constitutionality. I believe this is unconstitutional at a state level. I took an oath of office to uphold the Constitution, and I have a hard time voting for something that I believe is unconstitutional.
Why do you think it's unconstitutional?
There are three things. The first is a federal preemption that says food safety warning labels are the purview of the federal government, not state. Second is the Interstate Commerce Clause. 93% of our food comes from out of state. And then by doing labeling, we are requiring interstate commerce to make changes for New Hampshire. And the third is the First Amendment. Corporations have a right to speak, or in this case, not speak, if they choose not to label. So that was those issues. But I think the bill itself, one, has some cost, and there was no provisions to pay for those costs or to provide people for it. Somehow we have to enforce this. And you can't do it without people.
Okay. Bob, good to hear from you, especially since we just heard from your colleague on the other side of this. And Janet, I think I'll turn to you for this one, especially the interstate commerce concerns that our caller raises. 93% of New Hampshire's food, he says, comes from out of state. And boy, if you've got state by state different regulations on labels, you're kind of mucking that up.
Yeah. And in the subcommittee hearings, which it should be pointed out, I think the subcommittee met for over 3 months weekly to look at all the nuance of this bill, and they're the ones who voted for it, whereas the full committee only met once and voted immediately. So we feel like the subcommittee is the real experts on this issue. So,
Are you saying those concerns aren't valid, that interstate commerce could be disrupted and mucked up by this?
Yeah, I'm sorry. That was a quick aside. But in terms of the interstate commerce and other legal issues, the subcommittee did have two different legal experts testify, one thinking that it was not constitutional, one thinking that it could stand up to constitutional muster. The Vermont Law School has looked at all three of those constitutional challenges. In terms of interstate commerce, I'm not an attorney, but my understanding from those briefings is that the commerce has to do with having different laws for in-state and out-of-state manufacturers. So it could be argued that this would not be affected.
Yeah. Sam, I want to hear from you, and I have another question for you, Rob Johnson. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I am also not an attorney, and also I'm not an expert in this, but it is fair to say that there are legal experts on the other side of this as well, and so there are people who are concerned about it. And in the subcommittee, this was acknowledged to some extent that we might get sued. It's not necessarily sure whether or not we would win or not, but a lot of people on the committee and the subcommittee felt convinced that we would not be first in line to be sued. So if this became a case,
because other states have laws on the books,
exactly,
as well.
So even if that is a concern, it's not front and center, and it's worth it to push the federal government, in their opinion.
Okay, so Rob, a question for you. Our caller, Bob from Hudson, a state representative, talked about the First Amendment, freedom of speech, and that has come up. But another phrase that's come up, Rob, is the right to know. Consumers say, I want to know this, and I want the state to help me know this. What do you think?
I guess the question that we would ask is, at what cost? We don't deny consumers have a right, but at what cost, and is it reasonable, and what is it really going to yield?
Would it really jack up the costs that much to change your labels a little bit to add this information?
I think for larger producers, no, that they're already changing labels regularly.
Sure.
I think there would be some cost challenges to smaller sized operations, but that's relatively minor. I think there are other issues that I've already mentioned. Can I give you an example, Laura?
Actually, I would love an example, but let me hold you off for just a minute because we're going to take a short break. And then, yes, we'll talk about the costs coming up, and I'll let you give that example. So hold on there for just a moment. We'll also keep taking your calls, comments, questions, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Back in a minute.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Who's Hungry in America? And efforts to address their needs. Then more than a third of marriages in the U.S. are now between people of different faiths. Religious traditions and challenges for interfaith families. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from People's United Bank, offering retail and business solutions to meet banking needs in branches and online at peoples.com. And The Telegraph, providing local news coverage and advertising opportunities for today's complexities, online at nashuatelegraph.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, a history of Hanukkah in America, from minor festival to major holiday. Email us your thoughts before the program at exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. And join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at an upcoming food fight in the legislature, a bill to require labeling of so-called GMO foods. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. And Rob Johnson with the New Hampshire Farm Bureau Federation, just before the break, you wanted to give an example of how you feel GMO labeling would hike up the cost of food. Go ahead, Rob, please.
Well, I guess my example wasn't how it's going to hike up the cost of food. It was more on how it just generally affects growers, farmers in the state.
So go ahead, yeah.
Okay. We have a farm up in the North Country, and they don't have enough animals to apply manure to all of their acreage.
And they've developed a crop rotation where they have their land in hay 3 to 4 to 5 years, and then in order to add organic matter to the soil, they have a rotation of corn, soybean, oats. And they are using that first year when they're coming out of their hay rotation to plant, they plant corn, and they use a GE corn that is herbicide tolerant. They're using Roundup Ready, and they do this because in that first year of the intense weed pressure coming off hay, and they use it as a tool in their crop rotation process.
So it's once every couple of years.
They're using it once every 6 to 8 years.
But they would have to label, you're saying?
No. The challenge of the labeling is that there's a couple. One, they may be using it 1 year, and they'd have GE corn, and the next year they wouldn't. So if they're selling corn, they've got to segregate them. And that's two different bins, and it's a challenge there. And the other concern they have is that they would be required to label the corn in that 1 year, and they feel they'd be branded after that. The customers would not automatically think of them as a GE producer. So and they feel that branding would be a challenge, would limit their marketing abilities.
GE meaning genetically engineered.
Correct.
Yeah. What do you think, Janet Wilkinson? Sounds like a headache for this particular small farmer.
Perhaps it could be again, we don't want to pit farmers against farmers here in terms of organic versus conventional versus GMO. The simple fact is 90% of New Hampshire citizens want their food labeled. And
now, where does that number come from?
Just this past fall, a Melman poll was commissioned and found across the board, across all political interests, 90% of New Hampshire voters are interested in having their food labeled.
So somebody polled New Hampshire voters on this. Mm-hmm. Who commissioned the poll?
It was commissioned by Food Democracy Now! And NOFA New Hampshire, actually. And it was a survey of 500 New Hampshire voters, came out in October. And we were kind of stunned by those results, actually.
Sam, can you comment on what Rob Johnson said? We don't want to pit farmer versus farmer here, especially in New Hampshire, or maybe you, Janet, on this, you know, especially in New Hampshire, it's a small group of folks, mm-hmm. you know, and most people, if they're not organic, they're certainly not, you know, getting out crop dusting planes mm-hmm. and so forth. What do you think about that?
Yeah, we have a very friendly agricultural community here in New Hampshire. And my organization is not interested in changing that, that's for sure. But we also don't grow many GMO crops for human consumption. The vast majority of the corn that is grown is for animal feed, which would be exempt from this legislation anyway.
Okay, let's take another call if we could. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Waiting in Manchester is Matthew. Hi, Matthew. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me on. I had a quick question that I wanted to run by. A few weeks ago, I heard a report on the radio that the FDA had a massive recall of organic salads because of their dangerous levels of E. coli bacteria. So after reading up a little bit more on it online, I saw that organic farmers are using so much manure that organic food is now more likely to be contaminated with E. coli. So if there's this labeling issue is topical now, should we be putting labels on organic food warning about the potential high levels of E. coli bacteria that could be potentially in the food there?
Matthew, thanks for the call. What do you think, Janet? There are concerns about all sorts of different farming practices.
And it is important to note that the organic label is a voluntary label when you go through the process of becoming certified. So we would be okay with a label about being grown with manure. Part of the process of becoming a certified farmer and part of the education our organization provides is how to handle that manure in a safe way. And occasionally people get sick. I think we have a lot more foodborne illness in this country that goes undiagnosed through stomach aches and flu-like symptoms. So it's amazing, actually, we don't have more food-related sickness.
All right, Matthew, thanks for the call. Sam?
I think that this sort of gets at just the complexity of our food web in general. I mean, a lot of people would point out that organic or not, the problem that they see with the way food is grown in the United States is scale. And so when you have industrial scale organic versus industrial scale non-organic, you get problems such as the one that the caller alluded to. And so bring this back to GMOs. If you apply just sort of broad rules that GMO is good, GMO is bad, you can get yourself into these types of situations that are somewhat contradictory. Same thing with organic. If you say organic is good, well, sometimes if you have industrial scale organic operations, you have E. coli contaminated spinach. So I think it just points to the dangers of painting with a broad brush.
Yeah, Matthew, thank you for calling in. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email that came in before the show from April, and she made a lot of points. And April, thank you so much. I can't read all of them, but I'm going to pick two of them out. She says, people can purchase organic and other non-GMO foods, even if we didn't have GMO labeling. And she says, please emphasize the type of foods to avoid if you want to avoid GMO foods. Now, April is a strongly in favor of labeling. Let me just say that. But I did want to ask about these two points that she makes. What do you think? To you first, Janet. Please emphasize the types of food to avoid if you want to avoid GMO foods.
Mm-hmm.
Since we don't have labeling right now and you're concerned, so what do you do?
For the most part, I think Michael Pollan pointed out in one of his books, sticking to the perimeter of the grocery store is one good way to do it. It's all those processed foods in the aisles in the middle that are preserved for, you know, however many years. Some of the specific things that are typically GMO seed-based are canola, soy, corn, cotton, sugar beets, alfalfa. We're seeing a lot of papaya, zucchini, yellow summer squash. And it's important to know some of the ingredients that these lead to. So on that list, the like 20 line list on the side of a box, you see aspartame, ascorbic acid, sodium ascorbate, vitamin C, citric acid, sodium citrate, ethanol, natural and artificial flavorings, high fructose corn syrup, hydrolyzed vegetable protein, lactic acid, maltodextrins, molasses, monosodium glutamate, sucrose, xanthan gum, vitamins even.
Okay, and all that information gets to another question I have for you, and then I want to go to Rob Johnson as well. During the debate in the legislature, Janet, one lawmaker said, look, if you didn't have the internet, I might be more in favor of labeling, but there's so much information out there that you can get. So why do we need labels? If you're really concerned as a consumer, go find out.
Sure. It's an interesting experiment. I encourage some listeners to go try to eat non-GMO for a day. It's quite difficult to do, actually.
All right. Rob, I have another question for you, and this relates again to the labeling. We talked earlier about the cost. We talked about the hassle. But as has been pointed out, New Hampshire farmers aren't really involved in a lot of these processed foods. So the cost, you know, is it really that big a deal? You gave that example earlier from that one farmer. But overall, is it really about the cost, or is it more about just the philosophical feeling that we shouldn't have to put this label on?
The cost of labeling itself. I'm unclear on your question, Laura.
We talked earlier about the concern of cost of labeling, but in New Hampshire, not that many farmers are producing, you know, crackers or cereal, you know, processed food. So, is your opposition really about cost, or is it more a philosophical feeling that farmers just and producers just shouldn't have to do this?
Well, no, it's more than that, because there is a cost to farmers if by labeling it gives people an understanding that it's not safe, and therefore farmers aren't able to use the technology. Example is a young grower just outside of Manchester, it was a vegetable operation. And he currently doesn't use the technology. He would like to grow sweet corn using it. And what he has done is he's put a sign up over his sweet corn saying, ask us about GMOs. And he's done that because his fields are located as far as 10 miles away from his farm stand, and it requires time for him to, because he can't use it, he has to apply herbicides more frequently, and he needs to pesticides more frequently, and he needs to till, control his weeds, and it's time consuming. And it's a quality of life issue for him. He figures that over the course of a summer, he spends 60 more hours currently in his field than when he could be spending it at home with his young family.
So it is a hardship for some New Hampshire farmers, you're saying, Rob.
It would be a disadvantage if the labeling was seen as a health or safety concern and farmers couldn't use the technology where farmers in other states could.
Sam, and then Janet?
And this gets to some of the trickiness about whether or not GMOs are a good or a bad way for our society to go in general. A lot of GMO advocates will point to the fact that some of these crops have resulted in less tilling. They've resulted in less pesticide use because you have insect-resistant crops that are being developed.
So that's an environmental benefit using
right.
these pesticides.
And in fact, some of these big organizations have come out saying that on net, GMO crops are an environmental positive. And then, of course, you have the other side that's saying that this is leading to other crops are leading to herbicide dependence. Farmers are using herbicide-resistant crops, and then they're spraying with a single herbicide. It's creating super weeds. So, again, it's the dangers of painting with a broad brush. It depends on the crop. It depends on the usage. And some are more impactful than others.
Yeah. What do you think about either that environmental point, Janet? It's hard to weigh, the greenness of this or not, as Sam points out. But also Rob's point that not having access to this technology is a hardship for some New Hampshire farmers.
Sure. And, again, GMO labeling would not prevent this farmer from using GMO seed if he wanted to. But
there's the skull and crossbones effect, though. People are worried that would automatically turn people off from their products.
Perhaps, but that's really a PR challenge for the biotech companies, and perhaps they can overcome it. But for now, I think people want to know. But I wanted to point out this issue of contamination that organic farmers can face as well. I think there's hardship on both sides, and a lot of organic and non-GMO farms are really worried about the fact that GMO seed that's being planted in that field is under a patent. And that patent prevents not only the farmer Rob was just talking about from using that seed again, from saving it and using it again. It also, because by nature, seeds like to move, so they can cross over field to field by animals, by wind, by anything.
By a bird. A bird can pick it up in one field and drop it in your field.
That patent issue becomes an issue then for the farmer whose field it drifted into if they suddenly have GMO seeds growing among their own crops.
And I've heard that concern expressed a lot. Mm-hmm. But here's my question. If that were such a huge threat, wouldn't it have happened already? Because, again, GMOs have been around for a while.
It has.
It has happened.
Yes. Monsanto has been awarded millions of dollars in patent lawsuits, not necessarily on the drift issue, but more on the seeds being used when they're not supposed to or anything like that. The reality of drift with GMO seeds, I think it's evidence is mounting on that. It's increasing as we go along. I mean, remember, this technology is only 20 years old.
Sam, did you want to jump in? And then I have a last question for everybody.
Sure. I just wanted to backtrack just a little bit to the cost issue. And a lot of the studies of how much labeling would cost are based on an assumption that manufacturers would swap out non-GMO or GMO crops for non-GMO crops if labeling was required so that they wouldn't have to bear the label. And it's really an open question in the United States as to whether that would happen. In Europe, it certainly is the case. When required to label, a lot of people have swapped out. But that's really a very different food supply chain. Non-GM crops are a lot more available there. And so there's this question, would we be like Europe or would we be like other places? For example, in China, where GM labeling is required, there were studies carried out that
China
showed
requires GM labeling.
Yes.
China.
Yes. And there were studies carried out in China that have showed that label resulted in very little change in consumer behavior. And so that mass swapping of GM for non-GM crops didn't occur as much there.
That flight from those products
right.
that people
so,
fear.
So it's a question, these cost estimates are based on that assumption. how much that assumption is correct is an open question.
All right, Rob, your last thoughts on this bill, this upcoming debate in the legislature. What do you think is going to happen?
I would agree with what you alluded to earlier, Laura. Representative Bixby saying it was maybe a better chance of passage in the full House, and it may be the case. I know the legislators are hearing a great deal already from supporters, but I think the more people learn about what the costs are and what a label would really do, the less likely they are to support it.
So. Okay, and Janet Wilkinson, final thoughts from you as well.
Yeah, we've got our work cut out for us, that's for sure, but we really look forward to getting the constituent involvement and getting calls into our legislators. 90% of New Hampshire citizens want this. So.
Okay, and happy Thanksgiving to everybody, too, by the way.
Yes, and happy birthday to Freddie.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, Rob Johnson. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. You too, Laura.
Thanks,
Rob
Laura.
Johnson, Policy Director for the New Hampshire Farm Bureau Federation. Janet Wilkinson, thank you. Executive Director for NOFA, the Northeast Organic Farming Association. Sam, thanks for giving us your time.
Anytime, Laura.
Sam Evans-Brown, NHPR's Environment Reporter. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteers are Priscilla Malcolm and John Barrett. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, the history of Hanukkah in America. The 8-day Jewish Festival of Lights, known by the general public for its candles and dreidels, is an ancient celebration of religious freedom and a miracle. Now the author of a new book offers a uniquely American take on the holiday and how in this country it was transformed from a minor festival to a major occasion. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next at 10 on NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from Works Bakery Cafe, local cage-free eggs, naturally cured meats, artisan's breads, New York-style bagels, Concord, Keene, Durham, Portsmouth, online at worksbakerycafe.com. And Elliott Urgent Care in downtown Manchester, an alternative to an emergency department for accidents, illnesses, and injuries, or when your doctor's office is closed, ElliottRiversEdge.org.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
Good morning. It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. This week, many of us will celebrate Thanksgiving with family and friends. But for millions of others, the holiday will mark another day of worrying about how they'll feed themselves and their children. On November 1st, a temporary boost in the federal food stamps